This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Tuesday, November 24th, and we are live on The People Speak. I am your host, Sophia Ray. Join us every Tuesday for contemplative interview-style talk radio. For more information on tonight's show and upcoming shows, log in at bbsradio.com/thepeoplespeak. Interact with our featured guests by calling toll-free from Canada and the U.S. at 1-888-429-5471. Tonight we are blessed to be with the showbiz icon who has been around the block and back a few decades. He has earned the nickname the Godfather of Reality TV. John Barber is the host of our sister radio show, John Barber's World, that airs on BBS Radio Station 1 every other Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. It's an honor and a pleasure to welcome you on the People's. Thank you.
Oh, Sophia, thank you so much. And that was a really lovely rendition of This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land. Was that you singing, or who was that?
That's very, very funny. No. I'm not quite sure. You would have to ask Mike about that. It's a pretty good version. Thank you noticing.
No, it's actually lovely. I was very moved by it, quite impressed by it. And I'm sure the author would be, too, if he were around to hear it. Anyway, how are you this evening? And
I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. So we have, you know, we can discuss and have a lot to discuss. So let's start off on a roll because you are butter.
Maybe margarine. And you had me going around the block about the 15th time, so...
Just don't run, okay? Just don't run.
Can't do that anymore.
So, let's talk about you. This is all about you. And you are currently working on a project right now, is that correct? Like a movie thing going on?
No, we just finished it, as a matter of fact, Sophia, and I must tell you, you don't want to ever ask somebody who is a comic to start talking about themselves.
Oh, well, actually, I do.
they never, ever stop. But the project that we just finished, and I've said this for years, Sophia, all the best things that have ever happened to me in my life have always happened by accident. And always the disasters were those things that were well planned. I mean, if you look back, the Edsel was well planned, the Vietnam War was well planned, but it was only an accident they caught those thieves at the Watergate Hotel. And the project that I just finished was an accident also. There's a fellow named Len O'Sonic out of Canada, Vancouver, British Columbia, as a matter of fact, Vancouver, the most beautiful city in North America. And Len has an internet radio show called Black Op Radio, and by far he is the best host of a site devoted to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And he had interviewed me about 5 years ago when he first came across my documentary called The Garrison Tapes, which came out at the same time as the movie JFK did. Jim Garrison had brought Clay Shaw to trial in 1969 after struggling for 2 years against the federal government and national media, who were denigrating him as much as they could. And after he lost the case, he only lost the conviction, the conspiracy conviction, but he won the perjury conviction. And that's what he was really after. But the federal government stepped in after he won that and prevented the perjury trial of Clay Shaw. Anyway, for 10 years, Jim Garrison never gave another public interview until he did with me in 1981, and that resulted in what is truly, Sophia, the definitive documentary about the assassination of John Kennedy. It is Jim Garrison telling his own story in the Garrison tapes. Anyway, Len Osanek had heard this about 5 or 6 years ago, and he called me and he asked me to come on the show, and I went on the show. I got a call from him, Sophia, sometime in June of this year. And he said, John, do you mind if I come to Las Vegas now where you live and have you go on camera to talk about how and why you got involved with the Jim Garrison story? And I said, yes, I'd be happy to do that. Well, I thought nothing of it, Sophia. He shows up on July 4th, which happens to be Monica Lewinsky's birthday, Meyer Lansky's birthday, Neil Simon's birthday, and the birthday of the United States of America. So it was a very appropriate that we're talking about this very American story. Anyway, after he interviewed me for 2 hours, and we just talked like two old buddies, and he sent me the first 15 minutes about a month and a half later, and I was unbelievably impressed with how he had assembled it. And when I say accidentally, what he had accidentally done, he was began to tell the story of the guy who tried to tell Jim Garrison's story. Now, Jim Garrison lost everything. He lost his family. He lost his district attorney's office. He ended up being a judge and sadly died in 1992. Well, I had lost two or three of the best shows in television, and one of the very best shows was the show I created, which was Real People Over the Trying to Tell Jim Garrison's Story. So anyway, I called Len and I said, Len, you don't know what you stumbled across by accident. Do you mind if I come up to Vancouver and help you finish it? So I went up to Vancouver 2 weeks ago. Sophia, sat down with Len for two straight days. We finished assembling what is called, and your producer, Mike Kim, gave me the title for this, so he deserves the credit. It's called John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes.
I think I caught it. Is it on YouTube?
It is on YouTube now. You can go to johnbarbersworld.com. Then you go to the top of the page, you see the YouTube icon, and you click on that, and the first thing you'll see just below it is John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. And what it again has accidentally turned into, it has turned into a fundraising effort to finish telling the complete Jim Garrison story. I only told an hour and a half story in the first documentary because there was just too much material. But there is so much material about the American media. The American media that lied us into Vietnam, the American media that lied to us about the Jim Garrison investigation. As a matter of fact, NBC had a producer named Walter Sheridan, who was a CIA FBI asset producing shows for NBC. He was assigned to go to New Orleans and bribe Perry Raymond Russo, who happened to be Garrison's chief witness against Clay Shaw. Perry, who was just a clerk, called Mr. Garrison and said, they're coming down to do an interview with me. And Mr. Garrison said, do you mind if I wire you? So Sheridan and the NBC crew arranged to meet him in a motel in Louisiana, and they bribed him. They offered him $50,000 a year to go to work at an insurance company in California. Anyway, all of these recordings were taken down, delivered to Mr. Garrison, and he sued NBC, and he was trying to get Walter Sheridan put into prison and NBC's license revoked. And it should have been revoked. But instead, they gave him a half an hour of airtime to tell his story. And that's the first time he got to tell his story unhindered, but it wasn't prime time. But I got to tell his story in prime time. So what I'm trying to do now is raise funds to do part two, Sophia, which is called The American Media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
Interesting, very interesting. So who do you believe had the hand in his killing?
Well, it's not who I believe. Jim Garrison was right in 1967 when he said the Central Intelligence Agency killed him. And there's absolutely no question about that. And
I
from
agree.
Documents released recently through the Freedom of Information Act, we find the CIA assigned assets not only to denigrate these and to call them conspiracy theorists, but first of all, Mark Lane, who is the first one to open this Pandora's box of horror perpetrated by the government with his book, Rush to Judgment. Now, the CIA was saying, and the American media was saying, well, Mark Lane was just trying to sell his books and make a bunch of money. Mark Lane took his book, Rush to Judgment, Sophia, to every publisher in the United States, and everyone turned him down. He sold it in England for $1,500. That's all he got. And it was such a monster hit around the world, Americans had no choice but to demand that it be published in the United States. So that was that. And then
excellent.
And we find out that a lot of CIA assets infiltrated Jim Garrison's office and helped to destroy his case. And he lost the case because of one dreadful witness that he allowed on the stand that he thought was honest. Jim Garrison was the most trusting human being I ever met, which was beyond me. As a matter of fact, one of the questions I asked him in the interview, Sophia, he was a man who was not a Republican, he was not a Democrat, he was a former FBI agent, a law enforcement officer. He had himself photographed. He was in the military in the Second World War. And at Dachau, he sat on one of the barbed wire fences when they had liberated that concentration camp, and he wrote underneath it, "Lest we ever forget." That picture hung on his
hello,
wall.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm not here.
you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay. Anyway, he was in the reserve, and I said to him, "Mr. Garrison, whatever made you think you could take on the federal government?" And he smiled at me, Sophie, and he said, "John, I think as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies." Well, Sophia, that is a kind of offhanded, honest compliment that rings a bell to me and tells me he's telling me the truth, because I was like an orphan kid in Toronto. I used to go to a place called the Manor Theater in Kingston Road, spend 5 cents and see a double feature. And
5 cents? Wow.
Five cents at the Manor Theater. I was like 6 or 7 years of age, had really no family, so I lived most of the time at the theater. My favorites were Frank Capra movies, Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So I knew at that point that Jim Garrison was telling the truth, and I hope when you think about it,
well, he had a totally different perception. He comes from the inside, so he knows how it all goes down, and he just had enough, it sounds like.
Well, he kept fighting to, even on his deathbed, he was still talking about how the Central Intelligence Agency killed our president, and it was over.
Well, they killed a lot of people.
Yes, they did. And Bobby Kennedy, for example, I was intimately involved with that because I was intimately involved with Thomas Noguchi. Thomas Noguchi was the Los Angeles coroner who had performed the autopsy on Robert Kennedy. After he performed the autopsy for 6 years, the city council, the LAPD, and the CIA were trying to get rid of him because he wouldn't alter the autopsy report. You can Google it. You can go to those records.
Well, it was subjugated, it sounds like, and coerced by a third party.
No, it wasn't subjugated. His autopsy report says that the fatal shot, the muzzle of the gun, was no more than 2.5, 3 inches maximum.
Correct.
Left rear of Bobby Kennedy's skull because of the extensive powder burns to the hair and the skull. Well, Sirhan,
but that wasn't the original one that was sent out. That was the original one made, but they they gave the public a totally different view, correct?
Well, they always do. Look, right. Look what they did with 911.
That's what I meant by subjugated. It was subjugated, yeah.
I mean, Building 7 did not come down with a puff of hot air and smoke.
Of course not.
And the very, very bizarre thing that happened on 911, for crying out loud. I mean, I was in the news for years, and every time there was a news story anywhere, I would go from one channel to the next to see how they were covering it. Why is it the greatest disaster to hit the United States next to the cold-blooded open murder of John Kennedy? And then I'll have a thought about the Zapruder film. But is 911? We have 500 channels in this country now. How is it every single channel that we went to watch the buildings come down had exactly the same footage being fed to us by some unknown source? And the fact that the American people allowed that war criminal, George Bush, to lie us into Iraq because, again, like in Paris, some guy blows himself up, right? And they find a pristine passport. It's like this building comes down supposedly by an airplane or a couple of airplanes in New York. They do not find one piece of airplane that has any kind of reference numbers on us to tell us what kind of plane it was. But what do we find? We find a passport of a guy named Atta, who is an Arab. He is not an Iraqi. And the American public, there were a million people marching on the streets. And yet, we performed this horrifying shock and awe on an ancient culture. And the reason we did that was Saddam Hussein was going to back off of dealing with petrodollars to buy his
weapons. I don't believe that. I believe it had something to do more along with ancient knowledge and artifacts because of the raiding of museums and the restored temple they had been doing there for like the past 30 years prior.
But Sophia, that was the after effect. They wanted the oil. First of all, what he was going to do was the same thing that Gaddafi was going to do in Libya. They were going to go off using dollars.
I still don't believe the oil thing because iron and steel makes more money than oil still.
We don't see
about that on the media. Why don't we see anything about iron and steel? But our attention is always on oil. Why? It's like they're trying to detour your perception of what's really going on.
They're doing that. But more than oil, guess what makes more money now for the federal government than oil?
What's that? I don't know.
Student loans.
Because you're paying for the rest of your life.
Well, listen, 2 years ago in Quebec, the student loan rate went up in Quebec, by the province of Quebec, by about 2.5%, and French Canadians were out there trying to burn down schools and banks, and rightfully so. So they had to pull back a little bit. In the United States of America, if you have a boy or a girl going to college, and that student has to get a loan, you can never file bankruptcy. And if you die, your heirs have to pay your debt. Now, how reprehensible is that? You know, George Bush Sr. said at one time about 20 years ago, he said, you know, if the American people knew what we were really doing, they would hang us.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve to be hung.
And
I'm telling you, we need to be going to Washington, D.C. and building more lampposts from which to hang these people. Half of the CEOs in this country, half of the senators, and half of the congressmen should be hanging from ropes.
Hangman, absolutely. You know, this is Stephen in Canada, and he wants to know what you think about the alleged president of George H.W. Bush in Dallas today, since we were talking about JFK and all.
Well, George Bush Sr. can't remember where he was on November 22nd, 1963, but he was clearly in Dallas. And J. Edgar Hoover reveals the fact that he was in Dallas because the FBI and the CIA we're always at odds. So there is no, listen, I talked to an 8-year-old the other, a mechanic who fixed my car the other day, who just bought The Last Word on the Assassination off of Amazon. He asked me where I was on November 22nd, 1963, and I can remember exactly where I was. This man, I forget, I don't know how old he is, he was 8 years old and he remembers. You mean to tell me George Bush does not remember where he was on November 22nd, 1963? That is a bunch of bullshit.
I agree. That is a bunch of BS.
Nobody confronts these people about it. They continue. I'm going to tell you something, Sophia. From the beginning of time, the very beginning of time, the only people in a society that advance that society, whether it's in astronomy, religion, music, the arts, literature, anything, the only people who advance our society and knowledge are the black sheep in that particular society. Do you realize? And that's all the way from Galileo to Ed Snowden, for crying out loud. These are the black sheep who inform us. Look at George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had fewer than 5% of the population of the United States behind them for the American Revolution. They were the black sheep in the United States. Okay? What did Fidel Castro have? Fidel Castro had 10 guys in a rowboat. What did Jesus had? He had the Christian Dirty Dozen. And now look where they are. Billions of these damn Christians all around the world, for crying out loud. And so if you're considered a black sheep, it is a blessing. And what is wrong with the white sheep? Think of a herd of white sheep. What controls a herd of white sheep? One shepherd and one goddamn dog.
And one New World Order.
I'm telling you, H.L. Mencken, who was one of America's great wits and writers, almost up there with Mark Twain, said nobody ever went broke in the United States underestimating the intelligence of the public.
And I'm curious. I want to know something. This is just irking me. I want to know, so you're aware that President or Dictator Barack Obama is the head of the UN military?
Yeah, he is, but you want to know something?
Do you think that would entitle him the world general?
Well, no, first of all, let me tell you something. Barack Obama, like any president, Barack Obama happens to be a lawn jockey for Goldman Sachs. And the reason the Zapruder film is probably still out there. Now, think of this. There were a half a dozen really outstanding home movies made of the assassination of President Kennedy in Dealey Plaza. One of the most famous happens to be the Orville Nix film. And in the Garrison tapes, we interview the daughter of Orville Nix, and she tells a story about how they sabotaged her father. She is still suing to this day to try to get that film. Now, it's like all the security films of 9-1-1 around the Pentagon and all the rest of it. You can't see them. If the government had a plane going into the Pentagon, we would be seeing it. The reason they suppress it is that they're hiding the truth. They could have done the same, Sophia, with the Zapruder film. Now, we were first informed about the Zapruder film by another media hack by the name of Dan Rather. Now, here is a local reporter, the biggest, most important reporter to the United States of America at that time was Uncle Walter Cronkite. Everybody believed him. As a matter of fact, when Walter Cronkite finally said on the 6 o'clock news, "I don't think America can win this war in Vietnam," the war was over. Because if Uncle Walter said it, the war was over. But why wasn't Walter Cronkite the one to tell us about the Zapruder film? The reason is Cronkite probably wouldn't lie. Now, Dan Rather goes on CBS. He's just a local reporter. And we show this in John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison tapes, and it is also in the original documentary. He He describes everything in intimate detail, Sophia, from the pink pillbox hat and the pink outfit that Jackie is wearing, the clothes that Connolly is wearing, everything that John Kennedy is wearing. And then he says, I have to freeze the frame because now it is too horrible to describe. The third shot. And notice he says the word third shot, when actually there were four recorded. We'll find out about that later. He says the third shot hits the president in the head. Mm. And the head is thrust violently forward. He is made thereafter the $6 million anchorman for CBS. I offered Dan Rather's agents $25,000 to sit down and do an interview with Rather to find out who was in that office with him from CBS, from the FBI, from the CIA, from military intelligence, telling him he had to lie. In his autobiography, The Camera Never Blinks, Jim Maher says evidently it did blink in this case. He said it was just a lapse of memory. Again, that is total, total bullshit. The American media is, and get back to the business of the Zapruder film. Why is it not secret? Because they had it. They could have covered it up. You know why it's not secret? It is a warning to any man or woman who becomes president of the United States who has the gall to think they had the constitutional right to be running the United States of America. They are hirelings who are told what to do, and they do it. Now, if you're talking about Barack Obama, for crying out loud, we do not know what happened to Osama bin Laden. The word is that 8 years ago, he died because he had a disease. He had to get urolysis or some kind of special medical treatment because of a bladder disease that he had. So there were reports that he died 8 years ago. Okay, but let's say he didn't. And Barack Obama and all his fighting men go into Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever they go, and they capture the man. He is supposedly the most wanted man in the United States of America, except he is not on the 10... He's not on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Now, if you had the most wanted criminal in the world and you're investigating 911, what do you want to do? You want to get him into a courtroom in New York City and put him on trial and find out who he had with him. Instead, they waterboard him into the Pacific Ocean. What kind of goddamn justice is that? And what kind of president is Barack Obama? I am sad to say that the only reason I voted for him is because he said there would be change and there was no one else to vote for who might stop the war. He made it worse. And he has done more to demonize whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are the lifeblood of democracy. And he's putting them in prison.
Isn't that passionately said by you? Let's take this moment to go into a break. We will be back with John Barber in just a few.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
And we're back on The People Speak. This is Sophia Ray, and we're chit-chatting here with John Barber. John, I was watching the YouTube video earlier today, and I saw you mentioned a mutual friend of ours who happens to be passed away now. Rest in peace. His name is Harry Brooks.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, my goodness. He was such a sweet man. He was a co-host of a show called Speak Up America. At the time, the year was 1981, and I had created Real People in 1979 and in 1980. We were the number one show in the country. We had the highest ratings of any show in the history of television. We used to get a 50 share at Chicago, which was more than MASH and All in the Family, Sanford and Son, and all of them. And sadly, what happens is when the show becomes successful, they don't go to the creator, they go to the guy that owns the show. This happened to be, unfortunately, a guy named George Slaughter, and they asked him to do this sort of takeoff on the movie network. It was called Speak Up in America. And they had hired Marjo Gartner, who had been a child evangelist at one time, very nice guy. And because Herb Brooks was so popular as a result of the Miracle on Ice in 1980, they hired him, and he and I became very good friends. But I must tell you, his wife did not like the fact that he was in Hollywood at all. And they eventually separated, and sadly, I guess Herb died in a tragic automobile accident.
Yeah, it was said that he fell asleep behind the wheel, but for some reason I don't remember that. I know he was traveling 35, the Interstate 35, back to his home in Forest Lake, Minnesota. He was a frequent visitor at a bar that I had worked at, and gosh, he was just a great man. His personality was awesome. His spirit was always on a high level. And he had great stories to tell, too. And he told me one about when he was in New York and he was in the elevator. And a guy walked in the elevator and said, "Wow, you look like that Herb Brooks guy." And the guy goes, "I can't stand that guy." and Herb was just sitting there, and he said he didn't say anything, but he had great stories, and it's just a tragedy that he's no longer with us.
Was that Richard Belzer's voice that I heard just a little while ago?
Not sure, was it?
Yeah, he was plugging BBS. You know, Richard Belzer was also a very strong supporter of my doing the last word on the assassination. And you know what I do? I had a Facebook site for 2 or 3 years, and I never used it, and it kept going away. And the guy who designed my website said, "John, it's like a muscle. If you don't use it, it goes away." So, you know, I didn't want to communicate with anybody other than my family, so I didn't have friends. But to keep my Facebook site alive, I used to write jokes or make comments on it. And after about 3 years, a publisher contacted me from Los Angeles, a guy named James Griffith, Andy Griffith's cousin. And he owns a company called Wordsmith Media. And he said, "Hey, would you put all that stuff together in a book? And let's put it up on Amazon with the last word on the assassination." So we did it. And Sophie, it's called John Barber's Facebook Page, Uncensored Volume 1. And it's sort of like chicken soup for the funny bone. You can go, it's got 66 pages. You can open it anywhere. It's great, casual, and come across something that will make you smile or make you angry. Here, I just opened one here a second ago. And it says, "Muslim women, if they commit adultery, get stoned. But in order for Christian women to commit adultery, they get stoned." Anyway, if they happen to go up to Amazon in search of the last word in the assassination.
You are a stand-up comedian, correct?
Yes.
And how long did that last?
Let's see. I started in 1962. I had just come back from England. I went to England in 1960 to track down my father. My father, I came from a severely dysfunctional home, Sophie, in Toronto, long before it was popular, and I was brought into life by the beating of tambourines at the Salvation Army Charity Hospital. Anyway, when I was six, which is 1939, my father went to the peace and quiet of World War II and never came home. And so in 1960, I was broke. I was wandering, hopping freight trains and stuff like that. I ended up, well, I'm going to go to England, see if I can find my father. And I did. Do you remember a movie called A Place in the Sun?
No.
Oh, my God, Sophia, one of America's great love stories, Montgomery Clift.
And A Place in the Sun.
Oh, my God, Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift. God, it's based on a Theodore Dreiser book called An American Tragedy. And Clift plays this poor kid who meets this stunning brunette who is really rich, and that's Liz Taylor. Well, I always, because when I was younger, I sort of resembled Clift a little bit, they used to tell me. And so I identified with Monty Clift. Anyway, I tracked down my father in England, and it turned out that he owned a very successful advertising agency in Edinburgh on their main street, Silky Hall Street. It was the Angus Barber McLaren advertising agency. He picked me up in a chauffeur-driven limousine. Now, I must tell you, Sophia, I thought Easy Street was going to be mine. I thought I was going to be living the life of luxury, living with this extremely bright, successful man. So he drove me from London in the chauffeur-driven car all the way up to his studios. After he finished his work at the studios, he was going to introduce me to his new wife. Now, I don't know if he ever divorced my mother or not. I don't even know if he ever married my mother. I didn't have the foggiest idea. Anyway, what he was doing a commercial for a very successful sort of baking company. And the commercial was sort of like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And they projected this up on the screen, and they handed my father the copy, and he started to sing in this beautiful lyric baritone voice. I am a sucker for singers. My wife is a great singer. A lot of the people I know are great musicians. I don't know how people can live without music. That's why I liked your opening so much. Anyway, he sang it, and he sang it beautifully. I was so impressed. I was now going to be around somebody who was rich, somebody who would admit to being my father, and somebody who was talented. But for some reason or other that I cannot explain, Sophia, I cannot stop myself from saying some of the things that I say. I'm going to put this on pause for a minute. When I was at Adam Beck Public School, I was constantly, constantly in trouble. And when they would give you corporal punishment in school in Toronto at the time, they took you to the principal's office, they had a vase full of lemon water in which they had placed a leather rubber strap with metal bindings. And they would take out your hand and they would beat your hand till it would bleed. I had bloody hands for the 7 years I was at MBEC because I was always in trouble. But the worst offender for me was we had a teacher who was the only fat person I ever knew. You know, when we were kids, we never saw fat people. Now it's a plague of fatness all around the world. But it wasn't then. And he was forever griping. And one day he comes in and he's grumbling again and he has to have this oversized chair to sit down. And he leans over to the side and he reaches down to his leg and he said, "Oh, my ankle's swollen." And from the back of the room, I said, "How can you tell?" "Well, The class went nuts. They started laughing. Well, he roared down the aisle, knocking kids off of their chairs, dragging them to the principal's room. Well, my father had just finished singing this wonderful song, and I'm looking forward to going home, see his mansion, and to meet his new wife. And I said to him, out of the blue, and I don't know where it came from, I said, "Dad, you mean to tell me you abandoned your wife and three children in 1939 to come over here and fight the Germans in France, in Poland, and in Germany, and then to come up here to build this beautiful business and sing to a donut?" Well, he just stared at me like he wished he'd never given birth to me. He had his chauffeur drive me back to London. Well, I got back to London. I was broke. I had nothing to do. And I read this ad about they were looking for actors at a place called the Castle Theater in Farnham, Surrey. So I went and auditioned, and I was hired. You know, I could never understand why so many great English actors, from Richard Burton, all of them, were all such drunkards when they had a place to work out their craft. You know, and I don't know what it's like in Canada now, but in the United States, you got to become a waiter, a cocktail waitress, you got to be a gas station attendant and still pursue your craft. Over there, you could earn it. So I was there for about a year, and I decided, you know what? I could quote Shakespeare by the hour, like Richard Burton, but I thought, I do not want my life to be an escape from life. And that's what actors do.
Speaking about actors, let me cut you off here. You know, you really shape-shifted the television experience for the viewers today. All we see nowadays is reality TV.
That's true.
And you had the first reality TV show. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was. Well, what happened is I came back to California. I thought I want to be in charge of my own fate. So I became a stand-up comic. And as a result of that, my career blossomed because I did really well. As a matter of fact, when Merv Griffin gave up his show, he recommended me as his replacement. And they put me under contract for 13 weeks to replace him. And they went with that English guy who bombed, but I can't remember his name. Anyway, I was hired by a guy because I told him I had this idea to do a reality show. And I was going to call it National Graffiti because a lot of the stories I got out of the National Enquirer. And then there was that wonderful movie called American Graffiti with Richard Dreyfuss, really great early film. They should probably do a remake of that. Anyway, it became National Graffiti, and I had it. This guy had a development deal. It was the guy that owned Barney Miller, which was one of the really good sitcoms on television, without a laugh track and without a studio audience. And the wonderful thing about Barney Miller, you never hear anybody raise their voice because they talk in natural tones. Anyway, he had a development deal at ABC, and he said, "Go over there and tell them about it." So I met with a guy named Lou Ehrlich, who was head of the programming department. And I said, before I went over there, I did an interview with Daily Variety, a guy named Maury Gelman. This is 1978. And I said, this Canadian unknown dropout is going to change the face of American television with what I call the entertainment of reality, because celebrities absolutely bored me to death. But I run across real people all the time with such interesting stories to tell. So I'm sitting in Lou Ehrlich's office, and I said, "This is the show." And I told him about some of the stories we had. We found this stripper in New York City who was a stripper for God. She said she would take off her clothes for God because the money she got, she would donate to her church. We met the unluckiest man in the world, who happens to be in the Guinness Book of Records. His name is Roy Reap. So I outlined these stories, and I said, "I want my co-host to be Richard Pryor."
Pryor, wow.
And this guy leans over his desk, looks me straight in the eye, and says, "John, that nigger's never getting on this network." And I said, "What are you talking about?" Well, at the time, Sophia, Richard Pryor was in county jail. He had punched an executive out at NBC for censoring one of his favorite stories out of his special. And the Internal Revenue Service was trying to put him in prison for dodging his is Texas. And Richard and I were very good friends. We weren't close friends, but we always enjoyed one another's company. And I told Mr. Ehrlich, I said, Mr. Ehrlich, Rich in Oakland, Richard Pryor can put 10,000 asses into a seat.
That kid sure
could be the biggest star in America. And of course, as you know, he and Gene Wilder made these great movies for Paramount, and he became the largest box office attraction in America. And of course, Real People was only got on again by accident. I had been working as the critic at large on NBC, where I won 3 Emmys in a row for my reviews. And one day I get a call in 1978 or 79 from George Slaughter, who had been the co-creator of a show called Laugh-In, co-created by an English drunk by the name of Digby Wolfe, who actually came up with the title. Anyway, Mr. Slaughter called me and he said, hey, John, can I take some of these jokes that you have in your column about these movies and movie stars? They're really funny. He said, I'll pay you for them. And I said, George, I have a better idea. Since nobody is on your damn show for more than 30 or 40 seconds, let me write my own critic at large. Call me your critic at large, and I'll write my own stuff. He said, it's a deal. So I became one of the regulars on the revival of Laugh-In, which introduced Robin Williams to the world.
Ooh.
And you could not write for Robin. You could give him a premise, and he was such a genius. Like Jonathan Winters, he could go on for hours. And that's where I befriended also Frank Sinatra. I became Sinatra's special writer for three and a half years. But it was only, that show didn't succeed. But later on, when ABC had passed on my National Graffiti, I accidentally meet Slaughter again, and he has a contract for 4 specials at NBC. And he said, John, why don't you come here and do your show? And I said, I would love to. And so we shook hands, and the show went on only as 4 specials. After the 3rd show, NBC ordered 22 hours, something they almost never do. And by the time the end of the year was there, we were the number one show. We were the number one show for the 3 years that I ran the show.
What year was this?
It was from 79 to 82. I was fired on January 29th, 1982, which was my son's 13th birthday. And, you know, I sort of didn't mind because that's when in the Hebrew Jewish Judaism, that's when a 13-year-old becomes a man. So I figured, well, not my son is now a man, so I don't have to worry. But I got fired over the fact that I challenged him over the way that he maliciously and publicly libeled Jim Garrison. So we had a huge fight, and I was fired, and then Real People died, because you cannot take Neil Simon's typewriter away from him and give it to somebody else and expect the Odd Couple and the Sunshine Boys to pop out of 26 letters of the alphabet.
In those times, in those days, was the show business, the actor realm, was that as dirty as it is now today?
I don't know what you quite mean by dirty.
Well, you know, you got to do a lot of stuff to get airplay. And
well, I think in those days it was... If you're talking about the casting couch, in those days it was a lot more lascivious. Right now they are so businesslike, a lot of that has sort of been dispensed with. But in those days, it was very prevalent, I must tell you. Those dirty dealings that you're talking about. And since you love show business stories, Mike tells me you love show business stories.
Does he? Really?
Okay, I'm going to tell you an absolutely adorable showbiz story. One of the greatest 3 hours. Next to the 3 hours I interviewed Mr. Garrison, this was the most enjoyable and rewarding 3 hours I ever had. I did what at the time was the very best documentary about a performer. Ernie Kovacs was the television with Charlie Chaplin. Was the television with Charlie Chaplin was the film. The only person to use the medium for visual comedy was Ernie Kovacs. You Google him. Anyway, I wrote his life story. It's called Ernie Kovacs, television's original genius. Ernie Kovacs tragically died in a car accident involving a Corvair. He wasn't even 50 years of age, but the work he did was absolutely brilliant, outstanding. He was the first man in America to gain custody of his children in a custody fight, and his wife kidnapped them. So for 2 years, while he's trying to entertain America, he's searching for his family. So it's a, if you go to my site and you Google Ernie Kovacs, TV's original genius, you'll watch a great, the best 90 minutes about a performer, except for Searching for Sugar Man, which won an Academy Award 2.5 years ago. That is the best show business story in history. Anyway, after it was over, there was a theater called the Pantages where they used to hold the Academy Awards. And they had booked in a bunch of old-timers like Frankie Lane and Edie Adams and a few other older performers who could still really sing and perform. And so we went down to see it. And Edie Adams, who was Ernie Kovacs' widow and the one that gave me access to all the material, her date was George Burns. And after the show was over about 10:15. After the show, we went to a restaurant called Scandia on Sunset Boulevard. It is no longer there. Scandia had the best late-night dinners in the history of any restaurant. We would go there. Well, we got a table in the middle of the restaurant at 10:30 at night. So it's Edie Adams, her publicist, my son, my wife, George Burns, and another person. And George sits down and starts to tell his life story and other showbiz stories for 3 hours. Now, by midnight, the restaurant's deserted because they have to close, but they don't close because it's George Burns. So the manager and one busboy stays and stands aside while George tells us the story. And this is the story he told us that he got from Lucille Ball. I Love Lucy was on radio as I Love Lucy, and her husband was a guy named Richard Denning. Really good-looking, blonde, blue-eyed, tall American Irishman, really handsome, okay? Anyway, television is coming along. CBS calls Lucy and say, Lucy, we want to do a pilot for a television series. Do you mind, you and Richard? So Lucy says, let me get right back to you. So she calls CBS back. She says, no, I won't do the pilot with Richard. I love Richard. We'll keep doing the radio show with him, but I want to do it with my real husband, Desi. And they said, you can't do that, Lucy. A Mexican, a Cuban, somebody's, America's not ready for that. She says, well, I am, and everybody knows I'm married to a Cuban band leader, the guy who sings Babaloo. And they said, no. She said, well, count me out. So they called her the next day, and they called her the next day. And I said, only if Desi does it. So they decide they will do a pilot with Desi Arnaz called I Love Lucy. They shoot the pilot with Desi Arnaz. Now, what happens is, quite by accident, this pilot is sent to New York City. And the president of Old Gold Cigarette sees it. And he orders 13 episodes of I Love Lucy.
That's a great show.
So, what happens is CBS calls Lucy and says, congratulations, we've got an order for 13 shows. And she said, what do you mean, we? She said, you don't have an order for anything. And they said, yeah, we'll send you the contract. She said, no, you guys do not have my husband under contract. They had neglected to put Desi Arnaz under contract. So that is how Lucille Ball held up CBS to get ownership of her own show. And with all the monies that she made, she built Desi Lou Studios, becoming the first huge female entrepreneur in the history of Hollywood. And out of that
brilliant woman,
out of that came Star Trek and a dozen other things. Anyway, that's still, I've just finished writing my autobiography, Sophia, and that story,
can I get a copy when you're done?
You'll be about the fifth person to get an autograph.
Thank you very much.
It took me 5 years to do it. Dorothy Parker, who was one of the great wits in New York at the Algonquin Roundtable in the 20s and 30s, said, a great writer, she wrote for Hollywood too, she said, I hate writing, but I love having written. Well, that was me, Sophia. It took me 5 years to do this, but once I started, I loved doing it. Now I'm proofreading it, and you know, I used to say, if there is such a thing as reincarnation, I want to come back as my son, because he had the greatest parents of any human I ever met. But the truth is, I've come back as myself, because in writing this book, I got to relive my life a second time.
Now, I can't wait to read it. You know, John,
what?
You are the gift of talk, and I had to wrap you up.
Oh, that, in what, blankets, or?
We'll wrap you up, and we'll tear you open again soon, I hope. It was a pleasure having you on, and I'm looking forward to this book and all your experiences. Wow. And let our viewers know where they can catch this documentary on YouTube again.
Okay, thank you so much. If you go, folks, if you go to johnbarbersworld.com, and then just above that, you'll see a YouTube icon. Click on that icon, and then you'll see at the top of the page, you'll see John Barber's last word on the Garrison tapes. I am telling you, even if you are not interested in the murder of John Kennedy, but just love a really great American story, you must watch this, because it is truthfully very compelling, entertaining, and informative. And thank
you. Who do you
again,
have coming up on your show? Who's your featured guest on your next show?
Oh, my gosh. Harlan Ellison.
Okay.
He is one of America's great, bright writers. And I had him on two of my shows in Los Angeles. He just had a stroke a little while ago, but he's still immensely verbal. And I can't tell you the number of people already, Sophia.
And when can our listeners catch that if they're interested?
5 o'clock next Monday.
5 o'clock Pacific time?
On BBS Radio Network 1.
Alrighty, on the John Barber's World. So, thank you, John. That concludes
our night. Sophia, thank you. You're adorable.
Well, thank you. I want to give a big thanks out to John Barber for coming on and babbling all night long. I love you. So, it was great to have you on. I also want to give our listeners a big thank you. Doug Newsom, our engineer, and our producer, Mike Kim. Thank you, thank you. Tune in to us next week, next Tuesday, 9 p.m. Eastern. Let us unite through love and light. Be good to one another. Good night.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry.